Good morning, everybody. We start our session today morning with the title of Therapeutic Ethics and Analytic Concepts. We have two speakers. Both of them suggest something connected to translation. And of course, it's not only translation from one language to another, but a much more complicated translation. The first speaker is Julia Borosha. She's from Middlesex University Postgraduate Program in Psychoanalysis, and he was a translator and editor of Sándor Ferenczi's Selected Writings that was published in 1999. Please, Julia.
Oh. Right. Good morning. I wish to say that although I have in the past, as Sándor has told you, been directly, literally involved in the project of translating Ferenczi and looking at his words, moving between languages and thinking about that seriously. This is not what I will talk about today. Rather, I fear that perhaps the translation in the original title of my talk is perhaps misleading, although it does point to what I believe is the translatability of the implications of Ferenczi's thought as it moves across time, across discourses and areas of practice as well. So let's begin. In an extraordinary letter to Ferenczi's widow, written several months after Ferenczi's death in response to comments made by Lou Salomé, implying that he could have in some way saved his friend from an untimely death, Grodek outlines what he sees as essential differences in their respective forms of intellectual creativity and engagement. He contrasts his own self-preservative caution with Ferenczi's profound creative but doomed commitment to the pursuit of knowledge. He says, he became the victim of his own spirit of inquiry, a fate I escaped only because of my insufficient thirst for knowledge. I was horrified to see him proceed to investigate the human canvas scientifically, even attempt to describe it so that others could participate in this undoubtedly overwhelming spectacle. He became completely consumed by this endeavor. He expressed it thus to me, "I atomized the soul. Such atomization, if pursued seriously, could only end in the dissolution of the self." Grodek's remarks about his friend are striking, as is his citing of Ferenczi's evocative, elusive expression of atomizing the soul, which for me resonates with a series of speculative questions about the nature of cyclic knowledge, the power of unconscious processes, and attentiveness to relationality in the light of emerging new paradigms in physics. But might not this idea of the dissolution of the self, for example, imply a permeability to the other and to the social world? These are Ferenczian questions, I think, and linked to a particular ethical vision pertaining to the practice of psychoanalysis, a sustained reflection on power, for example, which Ferenczi doggedly pursued throughout his work as a psychoanalyst, and which can lead the way to the discipline's potential for adaptability, or translatability, rather. As Vladimir Granov put it, if Freud invented psychoanalysis, it was Ferenczi who embodied it. He traveled so fast, or rather, if one wishes, he was so quickly traversed by psychoanalysis that by the end of his life, in 1933, he had already almost completed the journey that the majority of analysts have only recently started undertaking. To my mind, one key element of what brings us together this weekend in this concerted engagement around the extraordinary text of the Clinical Diary is precisely that it points the way to expansive possibilities in the practice of psychoanalysis for our times and its continued relevance for the future, its extension, if you like, to the whole human canvas. What is at the heart of Ferenczi's willingness to go to the limits of what is possible to know, here contrasted with Grodek's understandable reluctance, I would ask? On the one hand, it has to do with Ferenczi's consistent willingness to be a fully fledged participant in the cyclotic encounter. However much the tenor of his involvement may have changed over time from active technique to relaxation to mutuality, his thought opened to the issue of power relations in psychoanalysis and coming to realize increasingly their paradoxical nature. The diary, Ferenczi's posthumous legacy to us, spells it out as a willingness to engage with seriousness and humility with the traumatic. For that is what it took to be open to the extent that he had been to the possibility, indeed the necessity, to be led by his patients, to be truly alongside them with all that that involves. It means ultimately to engage with the meaning of suffering and survival as something extending beyond the bounded individual. And this, in my view, pertains to the domain of an ethics of truth and justice. It also points to the potentially overwhelming immensity of the task, as Grodek cautioned. You know, it could really take you over if you're trying to engage with the suffering of all. But here I would like to offer you this image. Yeah. Taken by a photographer.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Do you see? Yeah. It was taken by a photographer whose name I wasn't able to trace and appeared in the English media in 2006. Although, you know, thanks to the internet, I was able to re-find that image now. And you may perhaps recall the news stories from the time. Boatloads of Africans were washing up on the holiday beaches at the edge of the Fortress Europe. Yesterday's news, upon which so many new stories of suffering and resilience have since been superimposed, and more recently, those of the drowned in the water surrounding Lampedusa. But that particular image has remained sharply in my mind ever since 2006. Terrible, yet also moving. And what stayed with me, actually, was hope. And we were struggling yesterday, actually, to reconnect with that notion of hope. It was very difficult, I remember, or discussing that in the afternoon session. But within the well-known tropes of psychoanalysis, it is almost as what we see washed up on the shore is what it and Europe was repressing, the dark continent, its radical other. The fragile, embracing tenderness of the near-naked blonde woman's gesture as she cares for the black man is set against the backdrop of all those racist fantasies of miscegenation so powerfully discussed by Frantz Fanon and others. The seeming embodiment of difference and the anxious fantasies it presupposes. But these, in the inclusive humanity of the gesture of care, become, at least in that moment, undone. And this is partly why, for me, this image stands as one important nodal point in an inquiry as to how a narrow cyclotic definition of the family could be extended and rendered truly inclusive to encompass the politics of friendship. Could Ferenczi's quest stand as a nodal point in this? One of the consequences of a sustained reflection on the limits which psychoanalysis as a discipline must always chafe against, as well as the possibilities of a cyclotic practice that takes seriously its sociopolitical situatedness, may well lead to a questioning of dominance of its most basic premises, the concept of the Oedipal family and the authoritative hierarchies it rests on. Is it possible for psychoanalysis to move beyond it to a broader conception of sociality? What could this mean? So, to cite Ferenczi, following disillusionment with parents, teachers, and other heroes, children unite amongst themselves and form alliances of friendship. Should analysis terminate under the sign of such a friendship? he asks in the clinical diary. There are, of course, many critical ways to read this phrase, but here I will merely let it stand as a question or even a metaphor. So, rereading the diary recently, after a sustained period of reflection on the writings of S.H. Fuchs and other group analysts, I was struck by Ferenczi's comparison of his mutual analytic relations with several different patients with a kind of group therapy. This was the starting point of Emmanuel Berman's paper that we heard on Friday evening, whereby he brought out the threads of unresolved envy and rivalry that connected the patients Ferenczi was involved in, and the disadvantages of this paradoxical structural situation, which entailed, as Berman put it, a group without a group, meaning without the containing safety of a boundaried setting. Whilst acknowledging this paradox in the situation described in the diary, that is not quite the path of inquiry that I will be pursuing here. Rather, I would simply like to go over some of the implication of Fuchs's extension of psychoanalysis, particularly regarding the authority of the therapist and the opening up of the possibility of a more horizontal, mutually permeable model, one which certainly, to my mind, chimes with the question, with the Ferenczian questions with which we started. It may be useful to be reminded that this form of treatment was developed by Fuchs in the special conditions that prevailed in the wards of Northfield's military hospital in England, in which he worked as a psychiatrist during the Second World War, the same institutional space which sparked Bion's ideas, the development of Bion's ideas on groups as well. Its premise is to take for granted man's social nature and the importance of the community in which individuals exist. Fuchs highlights the clear therapeutic lessons which we drew from working at Northfield. Firstly, he noted that, exposed to the dynamic forces within the group, psychiatrists became increasingly aware that they were facing the same problems as the group and that they were members of the group. The emphasis was laid still further on the group as a whole. The outstanding feature of this stage, therefore, was that treatment was not merely in a group or of a group, but by the group and, of course, for the group. And this actually, in a group, for the group, by the group, stands as actually the summary of what Fuchsian group analysis is about, one of its mottos. On an essay on the origins of group analysis, Pat de Mary further draws out the implications that neuroses in isolation is a relatively uninteresting condition, and it is only in relation to the context as located that its meaningfulness begins to be revealed, when meaning itself becomes located as the experience of the individual and the context establishing a relationship with each other, the individual and the context establishing a relationship with each other. In a late text, My Philosophy and Psychotherapy, Fuchs reflected back on his particular way of working, both as an individual and as a group analyst, in the following interesting way. He writes, "The true therapist has a creative function, in a way like an artist, in a way like a scientist, in a way like an educator. If he can avoid wanting to educate people in his own image, he will be able to help them creatively to become themselves, to lead a fuller life, to make use of happiness, and to avoid adding too much further suffering to their miseries. There is a great satisfaction in this creative part of our function. I have sometimes compared this function to that of a poet, especially in conducting a group." As is well known, Fuchs chose the term conductor rather than that of leader as being more apt to express his innovative and potentially radically revolutionary therapeutic vision, one which problematized notions of authority and expertise. Fuchs's expectation was that the group, within a frame carefully set, or to put it in the language of group analysis, dynamically administered, by the therapist. So questions of having a space of, face, of safety and containment takes on an agency of its own and the responsibility for its particular functioning. As for the therapist or conductor, confounding the fantasies and transferences of the group's members, he was put, quote, from the very beginning, he was to put from the very beginning, as he says, Fuchs puts it, the group as a whole into the center and submits his own function completely to the interests of the group. Arguably, it is precisely in the conductor's submission to his function to the group that the potential for creativity and freedom lies. This, however, is the hardest of tasks in practice, for it sets itself up against the group's and the therapist's own most primitive anxieties. An unconscious confrontation with the danger of annihilation and disintegration may be said to lie at the heart of a fear of unknown, especially in the early sessions of a group, and the desire for dependence and certainty can be a very powerful one. The temptation for the group, like for the patient in individual analysis, is to invest a conductor with a knowledge and expertise that in relation to the unconscious, the arena of the truly creative therapeutic encounter, he or she does not have. The conductor's corresponding temptation lies in yielding to the group's desire to locate this knowledge and expertise in his, her person, rather than in what the group is from the outset creating for itself, a matrix of communication. However, the group conductor does have a particular responsibility towards the group, and it is simply this, to do all that it is possible towards enabling therapy to take place for all the group's members within the context of this evolving matrix, to keep a conversation going. And the struggle lies precisely in resisting the temptation of educating and controlling in order for allow space for the free flow of unconscious processes, that is to say, the free-flowing, evolving conversation, to question, for example, the need for giving or receiving advice, or less blatant forms of authoritativeness in the obeisance. Elsewhere, Fuchs noted the astounding conformity, the ultimate conformity of the group with its leader, the one who is in the position of leader. But how is this conformity to be understood? Fuchs articulates it to the question of suggestion. He says, we can hardly overrate the great power of suggestion, conscious or unconscious, which enters into the effect we have on a group. While suggestibility is the property of each individual, the group hands over the suggestive power mostly to the leader. Now, the very problematic of suggestion and suggestibility is closely linked with the development of psychoanalysis itself, and one which Ferenczi was particularly sensitive to from the outset, as we can see from his early texts, Introduction and Transference. As has been well documented, the antecedents of the analytic relationship can be found in the relationship between hypnotizer-hypnotized, itself reliant on human suggestibility. In hypnotism, the power and responsibility for the cure seems to be clearly of the remit of the doctor and exposes him to failure. Some patients simply cannot be hypnotized. In the case of psychoanalysis, however, they are linked to what circulates between doctor and patient and the object of complex negotiations. And it is important to note that while suggestion was eliminated from the technique of psychoanalysis, the problem of its psychic significance via transference and counter-transference relationships remained. And a lot of the debates of 1932 around the confusion of tongues was precisely about this accusation, whether Ferenczi was actually, whether it was about a return of suggestion. That was some of the anxieties around that. But Ferenczi took care to distinguish, should be reminded, his active technique from suggestion, and from mere advice giving as well, or other forms of, or from an authoritarian type of pedagogy. So he was sensitive to that problem. But in these earlier writings on the active technique, he merely took note of what was being played out, describing the patient's responses as dispassionately as the technical means that he used to ensure the progress of the treatment. But he also acknowledged that patient and analyst, a priori subject and object of knowledge, are both, in fact, subjects of the unconscious. And as he pointed out in Elasticity, in his Elasticity essay, he said, the second fundamental rule after free association is the rule by which anyone who wishes to undertake analysis must first be analyzed himself. And in the clinical diary, he says, the best analyst is the patient who has been cured. But a series of difficult questions derive from this, the questions he would then take up in the last years of his life, really more fully. So these questions is, when is analysis completed? Indeed, what is the meaning of cured? What distinguishes the identity of the analyst from that of the patient? Can you even distinguish it? And what is the responsibility of the analyst? Is there one? In his 2009 Fuchs lecture, Authority and Revolt, The Challenges of Group Leadership, Maurice Knitzen touches upon some of the themes developed above. But he argued that Fuchs wrongly de-emphasized the importance of authority and the attendant effects of dependence and aggression. Ambivalent and changing attitudes towards it remain central throughout the life of a group, he pointed out. And furthermore, as Knitzen put it, authority in the sense of an internal conviction of authority comes and goes. It fluctuates not only from phase to phase, but undergoes changes throughout life. And it is his contention that group analysis has been weakened by what he sees as a lack of a robust and reflexive model of authority. But, however, in her response to Knitzen, Sylvia Hutchison pointed out that, in fact, an engagement with the question of authority lies at the very heart of Fuchs's thinking. And furthermore, as she puts it, he was a revolutionary in the analytic world in focusing attention on the potential destructive power of those in authority rather than those in a dependent relation to authority. But perhaps, you know, this is an example of the occlusion of where Ferenczi was getting at in precisely the clinical diary, because it's exactly about, if anything, it's exactly about the destructive power of those in authority. So in defending Fuchs's emphasis on the decrescendo, to use the technical term, of the group's dependence on the conductor, Hutchison writes, where groups form for therapeutic purpose, I consider that non-authoritarian leadership, which is not, in my view, equivalent to weak leadership, is appropriate to the task. In the terms outlined earlier, this is in agreement with the idea that the creative function of the therapist lies in the relinquishing of authority, having the patient, the patience, and the resilience to simply be alongside. And this is precisely the logical conclusion to which Ferenczi was led in his ethical quest recorded in the diary. The attempt certainly held elements of a utopian move toward realigning analytic power relations, forcing Ferenczi to confront his fears, his awareness of the fragility of his sanity, of his health, and his sense of control, his fears, in short, of placing himself in the patient's power. But why then, he asks, should he, the patient, place himself blindly in the power of the doctor? Now for something metaphysical, he speculates earlier in page 12. Some patients have the feeling that when this kind of mutual peace is attained, the libido, released from conflict, will, without any further intellectual or explanatory effect, have a healing effect. Patients demanded that I should not reflect quite so much, talk so much, that I should simply be there. But as Endre Kurt, our paper showed us, simply being there is sometimes the most difficult of tasks, actually, is being there. And that's, I think, Endre Kuratar's paper on yesterday morning showed us, for what may be demanded and by the work and would also need to be resisted is a kind of emptying of the mind and deadness. And perhaps what is needed is a being there in a capacity to stay alive and a connection to life itself. And so in the context of the diary, being there actually involved being alongside involved Ferenczi, being alongside some of his patients in the extremity of a confrontation with suffering. And it makes for hard reading. It really struck me, returning to this text, how hard this task was. And maybe we need to reread it to really engage with how much it involves the traumatic. As the psychoanalyst Marcello Vignard reminds us, albeit in a very different context, in a beautiful and important essay on the specificity of torture as trauma, he writes, "It is necessary to preserve the individuality of suffering and to examine how each individual either succumbs to suffering or defends themselves. Within the immense totality of statistical data, each case must be counted one by one. Ignominiously, a single human being stands for the whole of humanity, and is at once unique and special." And this, I think, points to the difficulty of utopian thinking, the impossibility of taking on the suffering of all, rather than taking it one by one, and yet the necessity to continue in that path. But now I wish to end by invoking the work of another photographer, the famous British war photographer and photojournalist, Don McCullen, a man who spent his life documenting one by one the most terrible images of suffering, not looking away and enjoining us not to look away. For him, it is not the function of the classical beauty of his compositions, depicting those who are suffering, grieving, about to die, soldiers, famine victims, those who may otherwise be abject or invisible or objectified, but rather it is a function of a recognition of the other, of himself in the other, and his own capacity, emotional capacity, to stay connected. And he says this in an interview. It was in Cyprus, about remembering an early moment in his career. It was in Cyprus. A shepherd had been murdered, and I walked into his house, and I photographed a boy brushing flies off his dead father's face, and the father had only been dead a short while. And I thought to myself, I remember when my father died, and his body was brought back to our humble little basement dwelling in Finsbury Park, and I remember the smell of the coffin, and the candle burning in the room, and my father's face. Elsewhere, he says, I've learned that the very best qualification you can have when you are in this situation, wherein you are exercising this duty, because, of course, he was not, he was troubled by the implications of the kind of work he was doing. He saw it as a duty, in fact. When you are exercising this duty, is that it is much better to be on the side of humanity. And I think to being on the side of humanity is a sentiment that Ferenczi would surely have agreed with.
Thanks a lot, Julia, for this wonderful lecture. It's really true that the ethical aspect of psychoanalysis is an extremely interesting and very important part of our work. Our next speaker is Hayuta Gurevich. She is training analyst, the Israeli Psychoanalytic Institute. Hayuta, please.
Thank you, Julia. I'm very happy to be alongside with you, and we meet in very interesting places. So, we'll see. My intention in this paper is to revive Ferenczi's central notions of the intrapsychic influence and imprint of early trauma and translate them to contemporary conceptualizations. Doing so is making a path of freedom inherited from Ferenczi himself. The concept of dissociation was central to the seduction theory renounced by Freud, yet it is returning as a cornerstone of recent trauma theories. Ferenczi, following Freud, usually used the concepts of repression and fragmentation, but did so in a sense of intrapsychic impact and imprint of early external trauma. This means that he regarded them as dissociation, disassociation, a fragmentation of consciousness itself, a vertical split, a psychic annihilating rupture, which is the automatic survival response to an external threat. The basic meta-theoretical assumption of the concept of dissociation is that external traumatic stimuli shape and influence the psyche, especially when it is tender and dependent on the environment for its existence. Thus, dissociation marks a fine line between the intrapsychic conflict theory and trauma theory. This implies that the traumatized psyche develops around associated self-states organized by fear of breakdown, both intrapsychically and intersubjectively. Dissociation lacks symbolic representation and compulsively repeats itself by enactments, fearfully yearning for recognition, containment, and to be lively associated with other parts of the psyche. Furthermore, the prerequisites for dissociation are of a double nature. Absence of protection from external threat, which is accompanied by an absence of containment by the caretaker of the psychic rupture that has occurred. Consequently, there is a rupture in the crucial attachment, which is in itself annihilating. Early mental trauma, then, occurs in situations of absence within absence. Let me elaborate on this. On January 24th, 1932, Ferenczi wrote in his diary, "Suggestibility, therefore, is actually the result of shock. Paternal hypnosis equals fear of being killed. Maternal hypnosis equals fear of being abandoned by the mother. That is, the threat that the libido will be withdrawn. The latter feels just as deadly as an aggressive threat to life. But the most frightful of frights is when the threat from the father is coupled with a simultaneous deserting by the mother. There is no chance to cry bitter tears over the injustice suffered, or to gain a sympathetic hearing from anyone. Only then, when the real world as it is becomes so unbearable, and the feeling of injustice, helplessness, and despair that things might ever change for the better becomes so absolute, only then does the ego withdraw from reality, though without giving up itself. Each experience of terror thus implies this kind of splitting off. all adaptation occurs in a person who has become malleable through terror, dissociation in the absence of the ego. The violent force imprints its own features on the person or compels him to change in accordance with its own will. End of quote. In this paragraph, Ferenczi recapitulates three basic assumptions of his early mental trauma theory. One, suggestibility is what develops when the environment does not protect the tender psyche from being shocked, when this external protective function is absent. The main inborn principle of the permeable tender psyche is that of resonating and adjusting to the environment. At its birth, the psyche is closer to non-being and in a state of dissolution. The realization of inborn tendencies, Ferenczi argues, depends on the degree of active adjustment of the primary surrounding to the young infant's needs. Prior to the formation of the self, extreme and ongoing conditions of non-adjustment of the environment arouse fear, interrupt authentic psychic life, and force it to dissociate itself for the sake of preserving the connection with a vitally needed parent. External reality is infiltrated and incorporated with no regulation and no filtering, and suggestibility increases. If self-assertion is not provided for and facilitated, suggestibility extends to hypnotism by the other, to an annulment of the will, and to compulsory, frightened, false being motivated by the will and needs of the other. On the other hand, facilitation of self-assertion avoids extensive adjustment to the other, enhances spontaneous and authentic development, and is felt as love. The opposite of love, hence, is not hate but fear, and the balance between the two is crucial for development. Point two. Ferenczi indicates that early trauma, mental trauma, is a double one, paternal and maternal. Paternal danger here is the external threat of being killed or invaded by excessive not me, indicating a massive absence of protection. All beings automatically respond to such danger by a shock and freeze if they cannot escape. Some fragment themselves physically. In the absence of an ego, the undeveloped psyche fragments itself in a way that parts of consciousness are dissociated from each other. This survival mode is pre-love and pre-hate and pre-psychic conflict. The second shock is unique to mammals in general and to human beings in particular. Born before they are independent, us humans totally rely on the other not only for physical living, but also on attachment for mental well-being. The evolving psyche is vulnerable to the extent that a massive breakdown of attachment, the desertion of its oneness with a mother, is an absence that is also sensed as a rupture in going on being, as not being. But the most frightful of frights is when both absences occur. Only then, Ferenczi points out, does the psyche renounce and give up any hope for any alloplastic adaptation of the environment to the inner shock. Only when both absences happen simultaneously does the psyche distort itself to maintain the crucial and vital attachment, and an intrapsychic trauma occurs. Only when a fearful and threatening shock is felt without any recognition by another of this total helplessness and terror does the external reality shape and change the inner one, and an autoplastic distortion takes place. This is an absence within absence in which, quote, all adaptation occurs in the person, namely a dissociation. This is one of those rare occasions that a double negative does not result in anything positive at all. Winnicott's formulation of X plus Y plus Z reiterates Ferenczi's original ideas, pointing out the annihilating impact of this absence within absence at the stage of dependency. The feeling of the mother's existence, quote, the feeling of the mother's existence lasts X minutes. If the mother is away more than X minutes, then the imago fades, and along with this, the baby's capacity to use the symbol of the union ceases. The baby is distressed, but this distress is soon mended because the mother returns in X plus Y minutes. In X plus Y minutes, the baby has not become altered. But in X plus Y plus Z minutes, the baby has become traumatized. In X plus Y plus Z minutes, the mother's return does not mend the baby's altered state. Trauma implies that the baby has experienced a break in life's continuity, so that primitive defenses now become organized to defend against the repetition of unthinkable anxiety or a return of the acute confusional state that belongs to disintegration of nascent ego structure. End of quote. The extent of self-distortion depends on the mother's awareness or her own dissociation of her baby's distress. Furthermore, the absent mirroring of the child's ruptured psyche constructs a distorted sense of what is me and what is not me, fragmented by fear of breakdown. Point three. The language of absence at the stage of tenderness is a language of negative imprint. As Ferenczi writes, quote, the violent force imprints its own features on the person. That's how it works. An external imprint. Okay? The violent force imprints its own features on the person, change in accordance with its own will. End of quote. Dissociation is an inner absence in synchrony with an anxiety-ridden identification, which incorporates the other's will, denying that of the child. The other's will operates from within as an alien transplant that is felt as me, while what is dissociated is threatening as not me. I'm speaking here, of course, about the intrapsychic consequences of the identification with the aggressor. The concept of dissociation is thus defined as the intrapsychic imprint of the external absence within absence, or in other words, its negative, the mental presentation of external double absence. It should be noted that what we have here is not the denial of the object in the sense of annulment or negation, but rather the intrapsychic presence and embodiment of absence, as in the negative image of a photograph or a dental imprint where empty spaces are the imprint of missing teeth. I will illustrate this notion by a simple instance from everyday life. Imagine that you hold out your hand, but the other does not take it, as happened to Ferenczi with Freud. No matter whether the other person just didn't notice or intentionally abstains, your hand freezes in midair, overexposed and overpresent, petrified like an unwanted object, feeling like a thing on its own, iron running in its veins. You are shocked, paralyzed, shamed. The initial feeling is fearful confusion. What's going on? Why did the obvious not happen? Did I do something wrong? You want to make the outstretched hand vanish there and then, and hopefully disappear altogether. You blame yourself for not predicting the situation, condemn the very wish to shake hands, and consider yourself stupid for expecting the other to reciprocate, as though the wish itself revealed an unforgivable, faulty self. There is nothing amiss with wanting to shake hands, and the outstretched hand is no shameful sign of malfunction. On the contrary, it reveals a wish to connect to the other. How did it nevertheless turn out that way? Shall we never again stretch out our hand in order to avoid further vulnerability and injury? Shall we offer our hand in demonstrative protest out of rage or as if nothing happened? No matter what we do, we won't be spontaneous when we are expected to shake hands again. The other's initial rejection is imprinted into our hand, forever alive and influencing from within, remaining a hand not taken. If we regard the hand as a metonymy for the evolving psyche, this familiar, easy-to-imagine experience exemplifies the automatic survival response to an absence of an expected facilitating environment. Spontaneous responses are dissociated. What is incorporated and identified with is the other's relation to the hand or the self. The psyche becomes the very lifeless thing that the other sees, or rather not sees, in it. This is, as Ferenczi describes, quote, a state in which any act of self-protection or defense is excluded and all external influence remains an impression without any internal anticathexis, end of quote, meaning no anger, no negativistic response, only, quote, a purely mimetic period, a partial relinquishing of the weak self-assertive impulse, and an immediate resignation and adaptation of the self to the environment. Primordial life is selfless because it does not possess a developed self as yet. End of quote. Absence requires marking, being signified. Non-recognition of absence is different than considering absence as a concrete reality which can be inscribed. Recognizing the no thing is a challenge because it can be done only via its negative. What we have here is not an object which is absent, but rather the perception of its absence as part of the actual existence. Thus, any absence of what should have been there in order to facilitate the development of the self is imprinted as a negative of the normal process of being, as a dissociation. The language of absence is the unique grammar of these internal absences and their enactments, and can lead us to understand the original state of traumatic ruptures of the self. This conceptualization has crucial implications for the treatment of dissociated patients. It is the analyst's aim to detect and feel his own inevitable absences for the patient to recognize them and make them present. Taking responsibility for them facilitates the understanding and involvement of their influence on the patient and his associated adjustment to them. Realizing their traumatizing effect in the actual relations turns both external and internal absences into presence in a safe and containing environment, gradually reviving the dissociated parts of the self and render dissociation as obsolete. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have now some time, a space to think, please.
I would like to offer some elements which could be interesting to understand the larger context which links Ferenczi to Bion, Paula Heimann, and Betty Joseph, and the problem of the skin containing and so on. At the time of the Northfield experiment, Rickman and Bion sleep in the same room. I know this for sure by the daughter who lived in Turin. And they chat all the night, they don't sleep, and they read together many pages of the clinical diary, given to them by Balint. At that time, they often come to visit Michael Balint at Manchester, and the two first candidates of Manchester was an institute at that time, English Institute of Psychoanalysis. The two candidates were Paula Heimann and Betty Joseph. So there is a link from Paula Heimann, Betty Joseph, and Ferenczi thought. But there is, about the transmission, a strong denial. For example, Bion quote only a few psychoanalysts, Freud, Melanie Klein, and Ferenczi. But Ferenczi, in the book of Bion, is never quoted at the end of the book and the list of authors. But this happened today, also today in the index. Ferenczi is one of the authors who is quoted in the page but disappear in the index. And Betty Joseph, I know in the past I knew Betty Joseph very well, denied her origin from Michael Balint. Another thing, I don't know if you know, Rickman was a patient of Ferenczi. And I know for sure that he is one of the patients on whom he reflects in the unwelcome paper, unwelcome child paper. The symptoms of the unwelcome child were the exact symptom of Rickman.
Thank you so much for this. Because if you read the theory, you could see them, the link, the occluded link between Ferenczi's writings to the right to the British independence via countertransference theory and so on. But that amazing you contextualize. You gave us the historical context so brilliantly, and that detail of actually Bion and Rickman reading the clinical diary is it's amazing to know that. So thank you.
Thank you for two beautiful papers. I should take them away and work on them over the next week, I think, if not longer. Just a thought about being alongside, being human, and bearing witness, which I think were all in both papers. I mean, I think it's right that when we're with patients who are deeply traumatized, we have to actually bear a lot if we're going to let the trauma actually locate itself internally and not just externally, so that things move between us. It seems to be as well, and this may be in your papers, I wasn't quite sure, that one of the tasks we have to do is to hold on to hope in the face of despair in the patient, that things can never be otherwise, because they come to us having repeated and repeated and repeated very painfully. And so part of being with is being with oneself and the inner work that has to go on to hold on to hope, which I think can be, you know, exceptionally difficult. I think Andre's paper was a lovely example of that sort of hope under threat. And one has to find a way of sustaining. There's a lovely John Bunyan. I don't know if people know John Bunyan, but John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress has a character called Pilgrim, who is in a dungeon. It's called the Dungeon of Despair in Doubting Castle. And he's locked in this dungeon by the giant despair, and he can't get out. And suddenly one day he says, "What a fool am I? I have the key of promise in my bosom." And he takes out the key of promise and he opens the door and he lets himself out. And it seems to me that's the other bit about hope, that we can't give hope to our patients. Somehow something happens in the process of actually processing it internally that allows them to take hope for themselves and find that sort of key, if you like, to get out of the despair. But thank you for your lovely papers, a sort of footnote to them.
Ayuta, I really enjoyed both of them, so lovely, but I wondered if I could ask... Oh, is that better? So, I wondered if I could just ask you a question. Where you started was, I have a sense of inside the traumatized patient, there's dissociated aspects of the self that might maybe a yearning to connect with each other but can't. And where I came to finally, and it was really beautiful, was the therapist feeling I might feel my own absence. I'm thinking of a client and I'm feeling my own absence, but I didn't know that I was doing this. But recently the client said that where it had started in my mind was that she constantly complained of being lonely, but she couldn't meet anyone. And I felt that, so when you said about the loneliness, I'm sorry, this is a rambling thing, this client came fully to mind, and that she felt that she was less lonely because she was aware of me when she wasn't in the therapy room somehow, so that as she was going back to her flat or whatever she was doing, she felt that somehow I still existed. And it was very hard for her to say that, but it was very, very warming in a strange way. I felt we had a different relationship after that. But what I wanted to ask you was about the loneliness and the dissociated pieces of the self. Is that reduction of loneliness... I suppose I feel I've understood it better now I'm asking the question, actually. Oh, I'm sorry, everybody.
I think that what you're saying is an instance of an absence being present, a presencing of your absence, because in this way, when she tells you that she feels your presence when you're not with her, she also acknowledges that she misses you, that you're not with her, and this is difficult for her. It leaves her lonely. So if we can... This is connected to hope also, because I think that if we can see many protests or any manifestations of what we usually call negativistic responses to the therapist as a manifestation of protest and hope for external adjustment that can be even returned, not by always doing it, but sometimes even recognizing how we're murdering the patient, how we're influencing him in a way that he suffers from what he actually suffered when he came to us. This repetition inevitably, I think, happens all the time, and seeing it as the negative or the consequence of the original trauma
can lead us to very different reactions, more with empathy to what is to the patient's needs. So I feel always that there's a strong, it's very important to differentiate between negativistic and negative manifestations.
To continue on the line of hope, I was thinking when I was listening to you, this passage of Ferenczi when he says, no patient is inanalyzable, how do you say, every patient is analyzable. No one, and that I learned very, very early when I was a very naive, I hope I still am a bit, analyst, and one of my very first patients was a delusional paranoiac. And friend's psychiatrist told me, no, you're crazy to take him in analysis alone in your office, and he was very delusional. And to connect with the question of recognition, for me, first of all, I never thought that I couldn't work with him. And I went very willingly, and I liked him to start with, even if he wasn't very likable in a certain way. But what was the main trauma, and I think I came to believe that's always the case, is what you were talking about, the non-recognition, or the disavowal, what Ferenczi calls a disavowal, which is, for me, I think, the essential internal trauma. And there's a disavowal of the trauma, and in certain cases, like this patient, it was a disavowal of his own being. The mother disavowed this little boy. I won't go into the, I've talked about him elsewhere, but her, when she described his birth, the only word was wash. So, and wash, I don't know how you'd say that in English. But, so I think the recognition of him as a being worked against his drama was, that was to be or not to be, to take the expression, English expression.
Because I should have, well, now I'm listening to you, I wish I had said as well, that it seems to be part of what the hope constitutes is that there is a developmental imperative, that if only it can be kick-started again, can actually allow the patient to move on. You know, whether one thinks about new beginnings or new objects or however one thinks about it. I mean, Anna Freud thought about this developmental imperative, so did Balint, you know. But it's that's part of the hope that we have.
Just to complete one second, this patient, he told me at one moment, he said, you know, I felt that you believed in that, you loved the little boy I used to be, and he was right.
Yeah.
When during this discussion, an association crossed my mind, actually from the last session I had with a patient in Tel Aviv before coming here, by chance, who is a relatively new patient, and I felt we are working pretty well together, but he came and said, I don't know about this treatment, I'm not sure I want to continue, something is not working right. And I tried to figure out with him, when did this doubt begin? And in the end, we managed to locate a moment in the session before when I made an interpretation connecting two stories he told me, and he said, but I know that. And actually, now we realize that he told me the two stories in a sequence because he understood there about the same theme. And I realized and I told him that by not acknowledging that he really knew that and that my intervention was therefore a bit redundant or superficial, he felt I don't want to hear criticism. He felt I am defending myself and wanting to go on as usual. And the association that came from him, which at first he said, I don't know why this comes into my mind, but later we understood, was an occasion when he told his father something very negative, another person told about his father. And his father made a joke of it and was very lighthearted about it, but 2 weeks later he exploded. And he said, how could you not defend me? How could you hear such disgusting things and say nothing? And I realized and told him that when I tell him I want to hear your criticism, it's very important, it will benefit our work, he doesn't really believe me. He thinks I'm like his father, who says, yes, yes, of course you can tell me everything, but sooner or later there will be revenge. So I think this was a very moving example of the Ferencian thinking about the vulnerability of the patient vis-a-vis the therapist and how much it's acknowledged or not. And my last association is because Franco mentioned Betty Joseph's background, which I think she really repressed deeply, because many years ago, Betty Joseph and I had a confrontation in a conference in Tel Aviv. She gave a case presentation, a very powerful paper she wrote about non-resonance, maybe some people know it, about a patient, a doctor, a physician whom she saw for many years, who did not benefit from the analysis, rejected all her interpretations, did not resonate to them, and all her interpretation was that this was his character structure. He could not resonate. He was blocked. And I asked her, okay, I'm sure you must be right to some extent, but do you think maybe there was something in the way you worked with him which wasn't right for him, rubbed him the wrong way? She said, no, I worked according to very good technique. It was good analysis.
Both presentations really touched me, and they somehow supported each other in many, many ways. And I started to think, of course, it's very basic, very important ideas. The first word that comes to my mind is that I'm being touched. And I think I'm trying to put it into words. I'm being touched because you offer a language for trauma, which makes it, maybe it sounds a bit absurd, but a livable experience. And make it, something that is obviously can be and is a part of our life. And I'd just like to come back to this whole, the lost children of psychoanalysis, the lost concept of psychoanalysis, this whole charade. One of the lost concepts was trauma for decades. It didn't appear. It was not in the psychoanalytical dictionaries. You can look it up. No, nothing. And the absolute denial of trauma, which I think it's partly the effect of the war and all the unresolved things that happened, not only in the outside world, but in the inside world and the inside world of the psychoanalysis. So, and then it came back to us, the concept of trauma, but something like
a ghost, like something that you really have to fear, something definite, something. Of course, you try to elaborate, but you never can, and that's all true. But then there is real suffering, and suffering is not shameful, or something which is in the history books or out there or out I don't know where, but it is a part of our life. And I think what you all say about hope is something that if you put that idea somehow together, then maybe it is a more livable a language for a more livable experience.
Back, Giselle is.
I recently searched the psychoanalytic electronic website, the PEP, and prior to 1989, there were really just a handful of entries on trauma. And after 1989, there are hundreds of entries on trauma, and it has to do with the publishing of the clinical diary.
Hello, just a short word about Michael Balint. Michael Balint's last work, which is not republished in French, called Psychotherapie Focale. Is it the same in English? Focal Psychotherapy. Balint and Ornstein, very, very interesting. He shows, I'm talking to Josette Garon, of course, how he analyzed a highly paranoid man through years, seeing him sometimes once a year, and sometimes 3 days, or sometimes a few hours, several hours the same day, and then 2 years after, etc. And the brilliant work he did with this. And this is a remarkable book, much forgotten, although it is the last book of Balint.
I would like to remember the meaning of responsibility. The meaning is to be able to give a response. In this way, Ferenczi taught all us, because the patient need a response to be alive, to be existence, even when we have not the right response, or we could say we don't understand, and we have an upset response. An upset response also give existence to the other, because the trauma is more traumatic when the patient don't receive a response, as Balint clearly expressed. The trauma is the abandon of the child and of the patient.
Thank you very much. We run out of time, and it's time to break. We go on at 11:15, a little bit 5 minutes later, with the session Ferenczi and Others, facilitated by Giselle Gatti. Thank you very much.